Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Duff Network, where we reflect on Rabo's most popular work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are here to talk about some more chapters from False Moves. But before we do, it's your reminder, submit some fan art to the fan art contest. You know, it's good. You can win a cash prize.
Yep. We've already got some submissions. They're great so far, so keep them coming. You've got till the 30th of July.
Yeah, just under a month now.
There's a link to that in the show notes if you want to, you know, read all the legal mumbo jumbo. Yeah, prize of $100. Theme is siblings. Please check it out.
Yeah. Shall we get on with the show? Oh, actually, also, in case you don't know, you can also come talk about this podcast and all the other podcasts on the Duff Media Network and any kind of related auxiliary media on the Duff Media Discord. You can find the link to that at duffmedia.com/discord.
Yeah, we're just going to keep beating that drum. It's free. It's public now. You do not need to be a patron. So
yeah,
any please old stop acting surprised.
Random can join. Any old nerd.
Yeah. Also, as well, just back on fan art, the pale amalgam sheet that we link in our show notes that has like all the chapters and the word counts and stuff.
Mm.
It also has a second sheet where Fairlax is trying to gather like all of the pale fan art that gets made.
Yes, it's a very admirable effort for sure.
Yes, but they're not omniscient, so you know they. I think they catch most of the stuff that goes on Reddit. But like, if you know of pale fan art that's mostly been on like Twitter or Tumblr or somewhere. I think on that sheet there's like a way to get in contact with Fairlax to basically submit that art. Please do so.
Please do.
We're going to be using it for All Packed Up too, so for no other reason it means it's more likely it'll show up during All Packed Up too, or All Paled Up. I don't know what we should call it for short. Our big 25-hour live stream. You know, stuff there, and it also just means that, you know, people will be able to find it you know, years from now via this sheet.
Anyway, should we get into it? We're talking about False Moves 12.2 and 12.3 today. 12.2 starting with Avery. We've jumped back a little bit before the Fae trial. Avery and Verona chit-chatting, and Avery makes her decision to go wolf mode.
At first I was like, god, another bloody like flashback to before this trial. Like, we had so much leading up to it, so I couldn't figure out like why there was possibly more to go into here, especially like 11-13 sort of went through how they were all feeling going into it. But this is like a really fun, this whole first half of this chapter is just hyping us up for, like, you know, Avery basically going full goblin against this fairy, and it works very well. Like, I am glad this these parts of Avery's flashbacks were sort of saved for this, just so this whole chapter can basically just lead up to her like ruining Finia's day.
Yeah, getting the explanation of why she's she wants to go wolf mode, I think, is great. Although, you know, this is kind of, I know we've talked about this a bit already, but it's worth calling it out here again. Like, what Avery is doing here is basically saying, hey, you know how there's this stuff that we backed away from doing for good reasons before, and we're planning on doing it now. And it just makes me think, like, I mean, this is what practitioners are, right? Is a sliding, very slippery slope of, you know, worse and worse things that these girls are now making an active choice to take a step down on. And it just makes your skin crawl a bit.
Yeah, Avery sort of directly addresses, like, hey, we need to be careful about the fact that what we're doing here is indulging in impulses we decided weren't healthy and we shouldn't do.
Yeah.
You're right. I think that's been talked about a lot, but it was good to see like one of the Kennedys explicitly call that out. It's like, hey, we should be careful. Although, that said, like in 11.12, I think it was, we saw Lucy like come to terms with the thing she did to Paul through this as a vehicle. And then obviously we'll be talking at the end of this chapter, Avery kind of gets over the thing she did to Pam earlier on. So like those two definitely managed to use it for like, you know, growth and healing and sort of coming to terms and stuff. So it was actually like the most healthy outcome. You'll notice that there's a one member of the trio I have not included so far.
Well, hopefully their journey of growth is coming soon.
Yeah, we'll get to her later in the episode, I'm sure. But at least for Avery and Lucy, it's been very much like Avery's concerned that this could go wrong, and it probably could have, but like for those two, it seems to have gone great.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like that point of this being growth moments for both of them. I think that's a very cool connection, and I hope to see Verona's.
I don't know. I have a feeling this third beat might get a little more complicated because for all of them, it's really coming back to the problem that was driving them in the first arc and a half, two arcs. Like Lucy, it was the anger and cursing of Paul. Obviously, with Avery, it was all of her shit with Pam. And then, yeah, Verona's got the Half-Light stuff. But I love that we're sort of using this stuff from so early in the story to really show how far at least two of them have come. With, yeah, like, you know, just the way they've both so maturely handled, yeah, stuff that really threw them, you know, what in their time was like 2 months ago, 3 months ago?
Yeah, true. It's been quick growth, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Avery's logic of like, you know, I want to try and be as nice as I can as much as possible, but when people fuck us, I want to be able to fuck them right back, basically, which I think is, I mean, it's harsh, but I do kind of like it. It's like, man, I feel like every time I make a comparison, I'm bringing up kind of modern, the modern world of progressivism, but I feel like it's this idea of like, you know, you can't politely ask people not to be Nazis. At some point you have to get a bit more mean, and I like Avery's embodiment of that here.
It is hard to not make those comparisons with this story.
I mean, they feel so pretty much there, right? I don't know
exactly.
Maybe it's just me.
No, well, it's at least just us. But yeah, I really love this as a moment because, like, Avery and Lucy, again, just to single the two of them out.
Isn't Verona meant to be your favorite, Elliot?
Yeah, we'll get to her later. She's in it later, but like Lucy and Avery have had this really interesting kind of inverse journey centered around like assertiveness and like, I don't know, standing up for what's right. Like, but like from opposite sides. Like Lucy obviously started sort of too combative. She was hostile by default, and she's been learning to like lead with compassion.
Mm.
Whereas obviously Avery was way on the other side and just like ran away from everything and, you know, was like isolating herself and was alone.
Mm.
And so while Lucy is, yeah, learning that stuff with compassion, it's kind of cool to see Avery start to learn the times when she just needs to dig her heels in and tell people to just like fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does have vibes of like, you know, that thing like people say sometimes where it's like you got to be like more scared of the really nice person when they get angry because I guess they've got more shit bottled up and they're not used to having to deal with it. There's definitely a bit of that from Avery where it's just like, you know, we see her go up against Finia and she's just like almost a little scarily good at just being like, okay, so how do I completely fuck up everything about her day? And just like not questioning that as her motive. Like she's set her mind to, I'm going to ruin Finia's day, and she's a little bit concerningly good at following through on that.
Yeah, I think it's I don't know, I think the point of Avery taking this learning to turn into somebody who's no longer, you know, shy isn't quite the right word, but you know what it is, like not assertive.
Who withdraws, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, it's a bit rough how far she goes in some of these scenes, but then again, it's against Finia and you can't not do that and expect to go well, you know?
No, exactly. Like, this is, like, it's a little bit weird and uncomfortable because this is very much her doing it in the situation where she needs to do it, like, too much.
Yeah,
like in general you sort of want it to be a step down from this, but yeah. Like, as you say, like this is kind of the situation where it probably needed this over the top nastiness. So it's hard to fault her too much for it.
Avery decides to be the villain of Finia's story.
Yeah, like as we said, like the whole chapter up until this point has just been like, sort of hyping up to the reveal of like what Avery is thinking with her, like, not actually a trial by combat, but like her flipping the table logic. And it's just so good. Like, yeah, all the stuff with like, it just felt so un-Avery. Like, I got kind of literal chills as I was reading her, just being like, okay, I'm going to be the antagonist. I need to figure out what is going to make her miserable. How do I achieve that in any way possible? Like, I was just like, fuck, that is so not Avery. This is going to be wild. And it was.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. You really are like, oh, this is going to go crazy. And it does. And it's so much fun.
As an aside, though, in all, like, I feel like an idiot when I realized this, but I was like, oh, that's what the wolf is. Like, and like, this all sort of came together in this chapter for me, but it was like, the wolf is just like a pure antagonist. Or I guess if you know, boot up the Forest Ribbon Trail and it loads your version of it, it's your antagonist. Like, I just remember in 10.A, we were like trying to jump back and forth between sort of it, like, oh, is it self-loathing or is it like what you fear? And because it kind of felt like it was both. And I think maybe we were just over complicating the whole thing. Like, it is kind of both, because like, obviously your antagonist is going to draw on both your self-loathing and your fear to ruin your day.
Well, yeah, the stuff that you are the most, I don't know, frightened of about yourself.
Well, it's just going to do anything it can to make you uncomfortable, bring you down, like fight against you. And that's going to involve your self-loathing and your fears. But yeah, it just like, I think it was funny because it was like, I was looking at it this very traditionally otherverse-y way of like, it must represent some like, you know, core concept or whatever, but like, it's a lost thing. It's something a bit more abstract than that. It's just an antagonist. And thinking about like all the things about it, like with John on the promenade, like how with his, it was just like the old white practitioner who kept claiming to know everything about him and own him, everything about its role in the Forest Ribbon Trail. I was like, oh, like, this is so obvious in retrospect. I think I went way off base trying to like overcomplicate what the wolf
overthink
was.
Overthink it.
Just, yeah, a pure antagonist to anyone and everyone around it.
Yeah. And that's what Avery's channeling here.
Yeah, which is like so cool and also scary.
Mm.
I just love it as a concept.
Yeah.
Makes me rethink like some of the stuff that went down on the promenade though. With like with the wolf kind of tearing apart the promenade, was that more evidence that the promenade is other lost coming together, or was it because the finders were working together, so the wolf was combating that?
Mm.
I don't know. It feels more and more like I'm starting to buy into some of the theories a lot of people talk about with like the wolf being involved in the finale of this story. I don't think it's going to be like the main conspirator or anything like that. I can't see how that would work. I mean, I've said that before and Wildbo's proved me wrong, so like, you know, like,
yeah, no, I agree. I can't see it. Like, I don't think the wolf is behind the Carmine mystery.
No,
to put it bluntly.
Yeah, it would be wild to me, but yeah, as I said, Wildbo's proved me wrong about stuff where I'm like, you can't make that work in the past, so it's so impossible. But like, yeah, part of me was like, I'd love it if the wolf was the big bad, because then this story would be all about fighting the big bad wolf, which is a very nice like bit of wordplay to build your whole story around. But I think that's how I work, not necessarily how Wildbo works. But I can see the wolf being involved in the finale in like, you know, maybe Mariska could do some bullshit to pull it out into the real world, or I don't know what, like, or maybe like, going to the promenade will be really important for the finale for some reason and fighting the wolf there. But it's just like, I just love the idea of like part of the climax of the story being centered around just fighting someone who doesn't stand for anything except standing against you. Like the wolf is just this pure antagonist. And that's like Pale. I love Pale, but like obviously a big thing about Pale is like all of the villains are somewhat empathized with and you don't want them to suffer. The wolf is going to be closer to Bristow, where it's just like, yeah, get shit on, you piece of shit. Like,
yeah, it's going to be a fun downfall to watch.
Yeah, I think like for part of the finale, I could see it really working to just have the wolf come in and tear shit up, and we're just going to get to be like, yeah, just fucking like fight it. Whereas with something like Mariska and stuff, there's still going to be a sense of like, oh, you need to do this the right way. I'll enjoy like a reprieve of the wolf just like getting owned.
Mm. Yeah.
And then we'll probably get to understand, because even Bristow, at the end of Bristow thing, it wasn't like a clean win. It was a bit like, oh, that sucked.
Well, yeah, it's he's ingrained enough in the system that cutting him out leaves wounds.
Oh, and even like sending him to the brownies, I felt a little bit bad about. Like
he chose that, Elliot. Yeah, I don't feel too bad about it because he chose that ending for himself.
I know. And wait, that's the worst part about it. Is it sucks, but it was like him who made it suck. But like, you know, I even if the wolf comes in to just sort of be the muscle of the finale or whatever, there'll probably still be a moment where it's just like, oh, that kind of sucks for the wolf.
Mm.
Like, if we get one of those for Bristow, I think we get one of those for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see. Can we talk about this? I want to talk about my feelings on the Aurum and how they evolved over the course of this chapter. Because, like, we see over the course of this chapter, Avery turned things from them being very much on the back foot and the Aurum siding with Finia on almost everything to them being very much on the front foot and the Aurum siding with them on mostly everything, right? It sides with Finia a few times. But basically, it feels to me kind of like the Aurum will basically just side with whoever is dramatically taking the lead in a conversation and like scoring conversational points rather than judging as, you know, somebody like, let's say, a judge would on a kind of objective or rational assessment of the situation. Like, thinking back to the Sable had some weird and disconnected moments, but felt kind of objectively like it was weighing things up and making a decision based on what it was presented. Whereas the Aurum just kind of feels like it's whoever has the momentum in the conversation, it will side with them. And it's kind of wild. Did you get this vibe as well?
Yeah, because there was a part of me, like, I was trying to piece together, like, the Aurum's priorities and, like, internal logic and rules as I was sort of reading this chapter. And I don't know if I just didn't read this one and the other one carefully enough, but, like, yeah, I was like, I can't understand the system the Aurum's using beyond just, yeah, as you said, whoever is just sort of talking the most confidently,
yeah,
and like kind of making some good points, but like more about just undermining the other person's point of view rather than making a case for their own.
Yeah.
The best I could say about the Aurum after like finishing these few chapters is at least by the end of it he was kind of equally unfair and full of shit. Like, just, it's like, you know, like a bad umpire, but they made bad calls for both teams, so it's like, you know, not like a corrupt umpire, just a bad one who's consistently bad.
Yeah, I mean, I get that vibe. And like, that's just obviously not reassuring in any way, right? Like,
yeah,
it's pretty clearly a whiff.
Well, yeah, because like, unless I've missed something, he doesn't seem to actually stand for anything. Like I, as you said, like with the Sable, you kind of got this idea of like, you know, this is what he thinks, and like, this is, you know, this is what he was doing. If anything, he probably went too far the other way. Whereas like the Aurum just, yeah, as you say, like never actually gives any input, just sort of like goes with whatever people suggest. He's never enforcing a rule until somebody else suggests it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of falls within that discretionary power the Sable went over them having. It's just like, fuck, it's frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. Yeah. I don't know. The Aurum is not my favorite judge currently, no. I suppose.
No, yeah. Like, yeah, just fucking take some initiative. Like, he didn't feel like a judge. He felt like a, what do you call it when people try to do things before the court? You know, they used to do it in The Good Wife all the time. Like where they meet with somebody who sort of helps them reconcile or whatever before taking it to court.
Oh, like an arbitrator.
Yeah. That feels like a weird word to use here, but you know what I mean? Like, just, he's not actually, never actually enforcing anything that somebody else doesn't come up with. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Letting bullshit happen based on how it happens, which is like such a shit way of managing.
Yeah, it's pretty shitty. I wanted to call out a moment that I really liked, just a moment between Cherry and Snowdrop where Cherry like jumps into a fey onto a fey and crawls beneath his armor and crawls around in like it's effectively a not as quite to scale but similar moment from Avengers where Ant-Man goes inside the Iron Man suit, right? And then Snowdrop tries to do the same thing, but it's just too big to really do it. So it just kind of climbs around on the breastplate. And I just found that such a fucking funny moment. I loved it.
I was legit emotionally affected by the moment just before this, which is when Cherry Pop first shows up and like starts crying as she tells Snowdrop how worried she is. And she's just like, I thought I'd never get to force you to chug milk again. I'm so glad I nearly drowned.
Yeah.
Cherry Pop's so adorably pathetic.
Yeah.
Oh. And the bit later where she's like, the parents are building a phone tree, which I think is stupid because you'd have to climb all the way up there to answer the phone.
Yeah, good stuff.
Such an idiot.
Classic stuff for sure.
We also need to call out Liberty's gremlin, who has batteries and a light bulb embedded in its skull with its hair sticking out, just because I fucking love it. Like that.
It's worth calling out. I mean, obviously, we've seen all the goblins. We see some like goblin weapon forms and stuff that we haven't seen from the local goblins. But all of Liberty's goblins as well are so funny. The one that's like a pregnant goblin turns into a gun that shoots out like fetal goblins connected with an umbilical cord. Yeah, so good.
And then they like land, chew off their umbilical cord, and then start causing mayhem. Like, it's just fucking wild.
Yeah.
I love, like, yeah, so this one, like, the little gremlin with all the batteries and the light bulbs, it turns into fucking, like, I don't know what you actually call them, you know, like, Asami's electricity sticks from Legend of Korra. Like, that's, Liberty basically walks around like a punk rock version of Asami.
Yeah.
And I was here for it. Like, goblins are so badass.
Yeah, it is very fun. And, yeah, I mean, they kind of start taking control of the narrative here. There's this bit where Lucy makes an argument because Finia is just kind of complaining about the goblins that are running wild and not arguing her actual points. And Lucy says she can argue for things to be forfeit because we're talking amongst ourselves. Her overwhelming focus on other stuff means I should be able to dismiss the charges. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, Lucy, that's so fucking good. Like, turn around her shitty arguments on her. So, so great.
Yeah, and like Lucy has a couple of those. They like Lucy and Avery get this great dynamic throughout this whole section, which is where Avery's basically just working with Liberty to cause absolute fucking chaos. And then as soon as Phineas starts to complain, Lucy just jumps on her and like twists it around.
Yeah.
And it's so effective. And you just like, it's like, because it's when they're using the actual like numbers advantage they have like over her, because then it just means that if she's not focusing on Liberty and Avery, they're continuing to make things worse. And if she focuses on the Aurum, that's when Lucy just sort of interrupts her and interjects and she can't do anything. And
yeah,
tide turns.
Yeah. It's, I guess we'll talk about this in a moment, but, it feels pretty brutal to Finia.
Yeah. I know what you mean. We'll definitely get to that. Before we move into the next section, I do want to call out the last thing, which is when Avery shoots the fairy that always calls out the demerit points with Doglick's tongue.
Yeah.
So it's like her mouth is covered with his like tongue.
Yeah.
And she can't talk. And she just sort of looks at Avery, and Avery just turns to her and goes, let's assume I get demerits for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to call this out because I often make fun of Avery's one-liners for being kind of corny lame. This one's just 100% badass. I chuckled out loud. I was like, that's a full-on, like, Jack O'Neill or, like, Tony Stark line. Like, 10 out of 10.
Yeah, it's a very, very good line, isn't it?
I very much enjoy that sort of, like, style of humor or badass. I was fully on board with it.
Yeah. After they've thoroughly thrown Finia off of her game, Finia tries to make a few last-ditch arguments. Some stick, most don't, but things are pretty much generally just continuing to descend into chaos.
Yeah, and I think this is where we'll start to get into what you were just hinting about a second ago, because there's a moment as this starts to happen where Avery starts calling in goblins that they didn't actually have on them, because the logic up until this point to get the goblins in has been we should get the tools we had on us.
We prepared them. Yeah,
when exactly. we came. And so they start getting, and then she calls in Blunt Munch, and he's like thinking, Blunt Munch wasn't here when this started. Please don't notice. Please don't notice. Mm. And like Lucy comes in to help distract her, and it's great. But as this was happening, part of me was like, I mean, yeah, this is great for the Kenneteers, but also like just once again, fuck the Aurum, because yeah. like
shouldn't the Aurum be helping to arbitrate this? He basically does nothing.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. He doesn't enforce anything unless somebody like calls it out. Like he's happy to let people abuse stuff as long as like nobody actively complains, and it's just such bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it is bullshit, 100%. I empathize with Finia for a little bit here, because her basically the argument that she makes here is like, you three are just coming in here and being practitioners, just kind of fucking shit up and being unimpeachable and enforcing your will on me and you know, all these fae. And like, it's totally true. It's 100% true. And yes, the thing is, that's the way you have to deal with this situation with Finian and with Faye in general. Having said that, it is 100% true. What she's saying?
Yeah, no, you're right. It sort of comes back to what we talked about last week with that idea of like, I don't know how else you deal with fairy. Like, yeah. If you come at them with civility, that's their playground and they're going to turn it against you. So you have to do this shit with goblins to even it out. And they do more than even it out. So yeah, well, yeah, let's not get into this again, because I still don't know, but it's like, yeah, it's, I agree. I feel bad for Finia, but also I don't know what else the Kenneteers were meant to do.
Yeah. 100%.
She does definitely lose points though. Like I find it a bit easier to reconcile, where she has this moment where she sort of says, you know, her example of how they're disrespecting others as practitioners is she's like, you know, you're not respecting my court. You're bringing goblins in and like ruining the culture of others. And Avery's like, well, no, we're just prioritizing goblin culture over fairy culture. And Finia's like, you're implying goblins even have culture.
Yeah, harsh.
And yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, look, you know, goblin culture is obviously not classically considered culture, but like gatekeeping other culture like that seriously undermined Finia's whole point to me. Like the way she's kind of like, you guys aren't respecting other culture, and then just immediately calling out goblins for having none. I was like, well, way to just immediately jump off your high horse. Like,
yeah, it pretty clearly completely undercuts what she's saying.
So it's like, well, yeah, I guess yeah, it's that whole thing. You're right. Like they are doing some practitionery shit, but also she's hardly exemplifying tolerance and understanding of the little man herself.
Yeah. 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 So yeah, Finia realizes pretty quickly that she's been beat and decides to negotiate after first starting to negotiate around the negotiation, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. And I mean, like, this is great because, like, the second the Kenneteers actually have it under control, they're like, okay, listen, we'll negotiate with you and make something fair. And she's like, no, you won't. And they're like, yeah, no, actually we will. You're not the fairy we want. And I just love this because it's like, I talked last week about my tinfoil that maybe that, you know, this was some sort of test of their sense of justice. And it wasn't that, but if it had been, they'd pass with flying colors, because the second they actually get the lead again, they go straight back to being like very fair and merciful. Like they're obviously,
they're not being spiteful about this.
No, they're very fair, especially because as Lucy mentions and Verona mentioned earlier, she was trying to sell them. It particularly hits home when Lucy brings that up. So there's definitely like the fact that they're really willing to be quite flexible with her here speaks magnitudes about like how good the three of them are as people in this position of power.
Yeah, they're pretty good. I love the clause that Verona puts in where she says, if you try something and we catch you, we can pause 15 minutes and an hour to deliberate. Basically, if you try and fuck around and be a fae, we're just going to let the goblins fuck with you back, which I think is a great general catch-all clause when you're starting a discussion with the fae.
Yeah, again, though, it's a little, like, mean with that, like, it's a form of torture, I think. But, yeah. There's a lot of good moments where the Kenneteers sort of, as they've got control, they're like, listen, if you just don't be a dick, it'll be fine. But otherwise, we're going to, like, you know, make you suffer for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is also the section where Verona asks for mercy about the gainsaying, because she's like clearly really sick. And it turns out that technically the gainsayings and the palms of the Aurum, Mr. Proactivity himself.
Mm.
And he just, yeah, he sort of says, no, I'm not going to change anything because, you know, practitioners' words have to matter. So you'll just have to live with this for like a week or whatever. And obviously that's hilarious because it's going to kind of line up with this 2 weekish deadline that fucking everything in the world is heading towards at the moment.
Yeah. But it is fair enough, right?
Yeah. Like, this was one of those situations where I was like, geez, like.
They didn't accuse a completely unrelated fairy of this. And yes, that was a shenanigan, but still.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear from like listeners and stuff what they think, because I think this might be the one case where I'm like, I think the Aurum's actually kind of fair on enforcing this part of like the telling the truth stuff. Like, and because it's not forswearing. Like, the thing that gets me about forswearing is like, Charles just has a miserable existence forever.
Permanently, yeah.
And like, that's bullshit. Whereas like Verona, it's kind of like just a week of punishment, bit physical, like punishment for my taste, but whatever. But you know, it's just like, I don't know, they did kind of fuck up. Like, I can see it.
Well, yeah. I mean, the defense I would say for this is like, they were intending to have a fair trial and Mariska was the one who fucked them over. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Others kind of need to have some level of defense mechanisms, so.
Yeah, I suppose as well, it would feel better for me if this whole truth-telling thing like was done in a way where the actual truth mattered. Like, you know what I mean? Like, one of the big things I've noticed throughout this story is just how bullshit all the truth-telling stuff is, because you can still lie.
Yeah, it's more about lies of omission and tricky wording than it is about actually, yeah. Are you being honest?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you know, I'd so much rather that whole thing of like the actual intent of your words mattering and stuff. So I'd be more okay with punishment if the system was fixed. But I'm not going to blame the Aurum for being the arbiter of, you know, this shit system. I think he's made the right call within that here.
Yeah, I agree.
Also, I just want to call out the nice little reflection on like Avery using this tactic of basically breaking down this fairy court into like a goblin, like it felt exactly like what America did when they visited the fairy markets in Arcade, where it was like you bring the goblins in and sort of bring it all down. And I just like sort of love the little connection to the fact that Avery does this alongside Liberty here to sort of do something good. Like, it's taking, I feel like Avery was probably inspired a bit by the shit America did a couple of arcs ago, but this time she's doing it next to Liberty to do something good.
Yeah, I think it's cool stuff. I just like that it's Avery and Liberty hanging out and being blunt goblin slingers together.
Do you buy into this whole, because I discovered this week that there's
the Avery and Liberty ship, is yeah, that what you're about yeah. to say? I probably don't. I to be honest, I feel a bit awkward shipping any 13-year-old girl with anybody, so I'm trying to just keep out of it. But if it happens, I would be too upset. You know, but whatever. So Finia concedes. Avery goes to check up on Pam, who has apparently been visited by Marisica.
But it's not so bad, apparently.
Well, can we talk about this?
Yeah.
What was Marisica here to do?
Because
the end result of what actually happened was basically just Marisica came by and insulted a 13-year-old self-esteem. And, like, sure, Marisica, like, it obviously will get under every skin, and that's great. But, like, it doesn't fit into any kind of grander plan, does it? It's just kind of being shitty to a 13-year-old girl. I don't understand what the, like, tricky fairy thing that Marisica is trying to do here was. Maybe it was just that because there were goblins around and because obviously Marcy got thrown off at Jasmine's house and stuff like that, like, she failed to do what she was trying to do. Because if this was her plan and went according to plan, I just do not get it.
I completely agree. I definitely left this and I was like, this seems like, unless there's a part of this I'm missing, it's very petty and vindictive for like a fairy plan.
Yeah, exactly. But it did
nothing.
Is it just to be shitty to Pam and therefore Avery? I don't know.
No, I agree. There has to be something we're missing with it. Because honestly, I feel a little bit the same about what she was doing at Jazz's place, honestly. The best I can come up with is like some really tinfoil stuff about how Mariska actually does want that whole, like, you know, the promise about giving them long and full lives.
Mm.
And so she wanted Avery to come confront Pam and for it to go well. You know, but like, I don't know why she'd want, like, you know, fucking fairy, man. I don't know why. I could keep going down this, why is she doing this rabbit hole, but I just don't know where she actually stands with the trio.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you compared it to the stuff at Jasmine's house. I mean, at least that seems like it has a purpose. And we'll see next chapter. It's helped lead to, if not directly caused, this two-week grounding, right? Which is obviously
I don't really think that's true. I think we talked about this last week, but like, they were already on a curfew. Like, I think Jasmine would have been upset with them and would have noticed they're gone. Like, it got worse because of Mariska, but like, I don't know. I still, maybe they wouldn't have gotten grounded for 2 weeks. Maybe it would have just been a 1 week or something. I don't know. Like, even the Jazz stuff, it kind of felt like, I don't quite know. Yeah. It feels like, there's going to have been something else she was doing with these two trips, I think. And I can't figure out what it was.
Mm.
My optimistic tinfoil is just, she actually is looking out for them in her own way.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think, coming back to this convo with Pam, it basically goes as well as it could have. Avery lets herself have some nice moments and does what she feels she didn't have the strength to do previously. And it's kind of a good growth moment. It's lovely.
Yeah. Absolutely. It definitely feels like exactly what we went through with Lucy in 11.12 with Paul. Like, as we sort of hit what I think is the end of the story, we're very much like circling back on these earlier parts of their journeys from arcs 1 and 2 and really rounding them out. And it's why I'm getting excited for the fact that now the big hanging thread out of those is the fact that Verona started dipping into the half light stuff. And I mean, Lucy brings this up next chapter, but like, Lucy and Avery were scared out of their two things that they've just reconciled with because they did something and they decided they didn't want to do that and they didn't want to be like that.
Mm.
Verona only left like Operation Turn Myself Into Another because she was worried it would upset Lucy. Then she's kind of dived straight in the moment she actually has an opportunity to get the okay to do it from Lucy. And in fact, in this part where they're waiting for Jasmine, next chapter, Verona starts talking about how she's going to try it again and what she wants to do differently.
Hmm.
And I just have a feeling that's probably going to be one of the big things the rest of this arc has to deal with. I think Verona, I'm very worried that Verona is going to go too far into the half-light stuff and really start to cause trouble for herself and those around her.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I guess we'll have to see. Yeah, I don't know.
Like, it'll definitely be something in this arc, because it feels so such a natural next step after like Avery with Pam here and Lucy with Paul a couple of chapters ago to head into Verona and the Half-Light stuff. But I feel like there's all these reasons for us to think the Half-Light thing is going to be more of a it's not something Verona has really been scared off of in the same way, and she doesn't have that same relationship with it where she needs to reconcile. She didn't make her mistake yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now she's going to be locked in the house for 2 weeks or something, like, knowing she has to go back to her dad's at the end of that. Like, yeah.
I'm obviously pretty nervous about this. I think it makes too much sense that we're going to get more of Verona and her, hopefully, growth, I guess. You never know.
I think by the end of it, it will be growth, but the concern is what happens in the middle there.
Mm. Rejoining the rest of the group, the Kennet Council and the Kentiers discuss what should happen next, and Toady begins a vote to exile Mariska.
Yes, because basically Liz and Mariska have both retreated, so, I mean, victory, right?
Mm.
But the Kentiers have won now.
Yeah, good job, Kentiers.
I suppose the rest of the story is going to be an epilogue.
The Carmine murder has been solved.
Do you still think there is another conspirator haven't identified?
I don't know. I do kind of buy into the there must have been someone else leading the show before Mariska joined. Just that one scene that has got everyone thinking, where Mariska, in Mariska's flashbacks, we went and saw her basically take over the Carmine conspiracy with Edith and Charles, and seemingly hint at another person that was running the show previously. I think that's just feels like a very strong evidence that there's something there. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, especially because I don't want it to be Charles. Like, the easy answer is Charles was doing it.
Yeah.
And I don't want that to be true.
I think Guillemet is also a top tier pick.
Yeah, he is. I feel like I've gone back and forth on Guillemet being a prime candidate, like, for months now. He's definitely worth consideration, but I just, again, he's an unwanted, I just don't want it to be him.
Mm.
He really wins me over sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, me too. Although, not in this next chapter.
Yeah.
So getting into 12.3, we're in Lucy's perspective now. Toadie's leading the vote for exile, and Guillemet and Miss weigh in with their thoughts and concerns.
Yeah. Something I really appreciate, like, that Wildbo / Lucy does at the start of this chapter is, like, refresh us on who's here, because it makes it basically very explicit that Charles is still refusing to show his goddamn face in this story, and it's just getting increasingly concerning / suspicious that he refuses to show up for anything.
Mm.
And then also Edith is the only other person missing that she notices.
Well, I mean, you know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, I really like how Lucy thinks, oh, somebody should go to Edith, and it's not like about guarding her, but it's more about protecting her and making sure she's not alone. Like, just good form, Lucy. Like, I really like that.
Yeah, she's keeping a lot of stuff in her head. She's definitely keeping all the kind of points that she needs to up there. So good stuff, Lucy.
But I do want to say, there's someone she doesn't comment on being there, and also doesn't comment on them being missing, and that's like Ken / Ken's kids.
Oh, interesting. Didn't catch that. Yeah.
Nobody mentions Ken being there, I don't think. Hmm. Or KT or Nettie or anyone.
Mm.
And I don't, because they are meant to be a member of the council, right?
Well, yeah, they're part of the new Ken and others.
Yeah.
I guess it's weird because they are Ken, so maybe they were there in a sense, but
Ken's always with us, I see.
Yeah, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, true. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it just jumped out to me a bit as, like, it seems like it's been a while since we properly got Ken's perspective. Like, he's really sort of split himself up into his component parts, and that's all we've seen of him for quite a while. And just, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm suspicious of this or what. I just keep noticing that, like, everyone's around except Ken.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a fair point. I don't know. I didn't even notice it, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, like, Lucy doesn't mention anything.
Yes, I guess I wasn't the only one.
But yeah, sorry. So to go back to the actual meeting as well, I just want to call out, like, as we get into it. Obviously, Toadslaw is, like, the new head here. There's definitely a few moments where Miss interjects, and you can tell that it's like she's got that vibe of someone who used to be the person in charge, and she's trying not to take over, but she can't help but, like, just butt in every now and then with, like, you know, the thing she would do in this situation.
Mm.
And you could tell Toadslaw is just, like, a little bit, like, you know, he's just constantly reminding her, hey, I am the one in charge now. And she's always like, yeah. But I just thought it was funny for somebody who's so against having a role that she keeps almost slipping back into the role of leader of Kennet.
Yeah, and she starts poking Toad a bit about his relationship to Mariska. And it's a little bit of, like, I mean, it's good because there is some stuff there. So it pans out. But even I was kind of like, all right, Miss, you know, you're not in the driver's seat anymore.
I 100% agree. It's absolutely good, as you said, that she asked her. Because Toadslaw is, I don't want to call it testimony, but, like, his little speech about Mariska, he's actually the one who far and away comes closest to figuring out what's actually going on with her.
Yeah.
He's like, she's a bit odd for a fairy. Like, she doesn't seem to want what normal fairy want. And I was like, yes. And then he's like, and she's always doing things to, like, mask her trail and, like, so people won't know where she is. And I'm like, yes, you're almost there. Go on. Like, it felt like you know, Mist just has those instincts and that ability to notice things that are going to disappear, and it feels like maybe she was channeling that when she asked him, because he's absolutely the one who seems the closest to figuring her out.
Yeah, it was definitely a good ask by Mist. But I think Toady is being very, very fair in this. Like, this exile of Mariska is basically, she's in exile unless she wants to come and explain to us, at which point we'll give her a chance to explain. Like, that's a more fair deal than, yeah.
Yeah, that is outrageously reasonable. I've got to worry, as we've mentioned with Fairy, you've always got to be a bit wary about giving them the ability to discuss things. But, the fact that they do this for both Mariska and Liz, I was very much like, okay, yeah, like, this is very fair. And it's just like, hey, you're banned until we can talk to you about this. Like, you can't argue with that.
Yeah, it's exceedingly fair. Can we talk about Guillaume? Because, so, Guillaume basically stops the proceedings to be like, no, I have to tell you this very, very important thing that it's really important I say before we do this vote. And then what he basically says is, Mariska might have a friend that I know about and we should go check it out, right? Like, that's pretty much it.
It's absolutely the sort of stuff that should have been in an email.
Yeah, it so is. And I'm kind of like, is... So is this part of Guillaume in his fall to winter being just like obstinate and you know obtuse? Or is Guillaume genuinely buying time intentionally from Mariska before she's exiled? So, because, you know, as soon as she gets exiled, apparently they'll be able to tell, like, is she in Canada, etc. Right? So maybe she has to do like one final shenanigan before she leaves. And Guillaume is buying time for that. Like, that's how ridiculous this seemed from Guillaume. That was my go-to explanation.
So my argument against it being him buying time for Mariska is just, he's meant to be better than that. Like, this felt so much like shitty time padding that, like, I think, you know, him simultaneously calling Mariska an embarrassment for Fairy for being unsubtle would be wild if, like, he's doing that as he's clunkily buying her 5 extra minutes to do a plan in town. Yeah, I just wondered if maybe he got really excited by the opportunity to kind of soapbox about how shit Mariska is. Or maybe it probably just does have to do with the fact that not just that he's falling to winter, but that he's a fairy. And like a sort of through line throughout this whole section is obviously that, like, Lucy is just jonesing to get out of here. Like, she's understandably in a bit of a rush to get home and make sure everything's okay. And, like, Guillaume just doesn't think about time factors like that. Like, you know, he's always Mr. Patient. So, like, this could just be him being a fairy and not, like, you know, channeling that other energy with, like, how the others waited, like, 2 or 3 months or whatever to actually awaken the Kenneteers. Whole othery vibe of, like, oh, yeah, mortality.
Yeah, I guess it's a lead-in from previous chapter discussing, like, human mortality and time spans. And now this, where these, you know, eternal, mostly eternal beings just don't have good conceptions of the concept of urgency.
Yeah, well, and I think there's like other through lines between what just went down with Finnear in this meeting, because another thing that really comes up is, like, Toadslaw keeps being like, Guillaume, you're distracting us. And then when Guillaume keeps doing it, Toadslaw, of course, being the mature man that he is, responds by getting even more distracting and off topic. And there's just this real vibe to this meeting where, like, Guillaume will take them slightly off topic, and Toadslaw responds by just escalating it in the worst way possible. And then people like Matthew keep having to be like, guys, can we please get back on topic? Like,
yeah.
Guillaume and Toadslaw work off each other in just the worst way for both of them, which is hilarious as well, because they're two of the, like, smartest schemers in this town. Mm-hmm. So just the image of, like, these two master schemers fucking you're face planting on each other as they're, like, playing off each other in this terrible way is just funny, because they come across like idiots. But it really sort of sells, like, some of the stuff we started talking about with Finnear last chapter, which is, like, you know, we're trying to build this coalition of all others and respect them all, but, like, goblins and fairy, particularly winter fairy, are operating in very different ways, and, like, it's not all going to be smooth sailing. Like we used to talk about this a lot with the Kenneteers, like they all work as different people. And a big part of teamwork isn't getting everyone on the same wavelength. It's about making sure everybody can work with each other's different wavelengths.
And kind of support each other's, you know, strengths and weaknesses in the right ways.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we feel we see Toad Swallow and Guillaume fail to do that with each other here. And yeah. Again, I wonder if that's sort of something we're going to start talking about a lot more as we sort of defeated Finia being this toxic representation of that. It's sort of like, okay, but now we've got a bit of time off from our major villains. How does like a place like Kennet grow with all these very different people in it and without someone like Miss in charge? Like if you have a quote-unquote biased person like Toad Swallow on there, how do you... Can this place work?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, kind of a frustrating interaction between Toadie and Guillaume, isn't it?
But also funny. Like, as I said, watching these two very clever guys just make idiots of themselves because they just can't stand the way the other one operates. It's very, like, humbling for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very excited to meet all these other characters Guillaume does introduce us to. Like, the pretty guy. Sounds neat. He ties into some of the alchemy stuff, I bet, so that'll be fun. But I'm much more excited for the fauna ephemera because they just sound like evil Disney animals. I'm so into that.
Yeah.
Like, they sound like the mice who dressed Cinderella, except they'll strangle you with the ribbons.
Yeah. Yeah, I also am excited to meet this thing.
Like, yeah, the idea of, like, animals that travel in packs and are very beautiful but, like, will actually be crafty and conniving with a flair for the dramatic. I was like, yes, please.
So, yeah, Lucy starts to really lose her patience here as the vote finally kicks off. It's unanimous. And then the discussions and planning kind of continue.
Yeah, and, like, poor Lucy just really needed to have mentioned that she was in a rush earlier, huh?
Well, she says to Toadie that she's mentioned it before politely, and I was like, Lucy, you didn't really mention it that much. But yeah,
it was quite passive aggressive, perhaps. Yeah. Like it felt a bit like reading one of those Verona you know, we've had a few Verona chapters where she's just like bottling something up until she explodes. Like 9.9 is obviously the big one. But it's like, it's a bit of a Verona chapter staple to sort of slowly watch her bottle things up until she explodes. And I got really worried that we were about to watch Lucy do exactly that, as she just kept, like, sort of calmly and indirectly bringing things up to people. Eventually, she just sort of has to be like, guys, I really need to fucking leave. Can we hurry this up?
We'll I guess we will get to why Lucy needed to leave in a moment. But before we move on, I'm kind of really excited and interested to see the scene of the Sig questioning, because like Sig is so fascinating and such an interesting character to me, but I think the fact that Sig is pretty clearly not super like sentient, maybe the least sentient character that we know of in the story, I'm kind of expecting to have my heart broken by what Sig will actually be like if we get a chance to talk to them. I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah, because we obviously had that Sig interlude, and like we talked about it when it came up, but he was missing so much of like emotion and certain parts of observation. Like,
yeah, he almost seemed like a passive observer in his own life, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like he clearly draws a lot of his experience of the world from the people who are around wherever he is. A part of me almost wishes that like. Oh, sorry, not wishes, hopes, that we're going to get his interview in one of these dream sequences with Alpi that we're setting up at the end of the chapter. Just because we can interview him by having him roll around on books or whatever the fuck Edith used to do. And that can work, but like, fuck, I'd love to see the personification of Sig and like what his version of like, you know, Monty being like Mr. Classy, you know, is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. If it's an Alpi dream, as obviously we get some indication that it might be, that might smooth it over a bit more. I don't know. We'll have to see, I suppose. I'm nervous about what Sig interactions with Sig will actually be like. Yeah, I just like them and I want them to be so nice and lovely, but I just anticipate things aren't going to be that good.
Well, what was interesting is when we had the Sig interlude, I didn't get the impression that there was like that level of motive behind some of his actions. Like, you know, like there was never that sense of like, I am like doing this for this like underlying goal-driven reason. He would sort of do what Edith told him, but there, I don't know. You just didn't get that sense of like he respected Edith for XYZ. I'm so interested to learn why he was siding with Edith. Was it just because she was a fire-based spirit, or like, you know, were there philosophical reasons? He didn't feel very philosophical. So yeah, I don't know. I can't wait to see this.
Yeah. So yeah, Lucy loses her patience with all these eternal and motherless others, and she and Verona depart for their house, ready to face the music as Jasmine drives over to pick them up.
Yeah, and Lucy's thought as they're walking away is like, her big problem with this meeting is there's so much bureaucracy and decision making and all this crap involved in that meeting. And I just thought that was a really interesting complaint to have after the fight with Finia with the Aurum, because like, we kind of saw what arbitration through a single streamlined judge gets you with the fight against Finia. Like, that's got its own problems. It's wild to me that Lucy was sort of in the headspace of like, oh, I wish we could have just like rushed this judgment on Marissica and Liz, because this idea to exile them and stuff isn't something I'd be super comfortable with if they like rushed it and didn't talk it out. I think obviously Guillaume talked it out a bit too much, but yeah, I don't know, worth talking about. I don't know. Eventually what happens is Lucy just leaves Avery to be like her and Verona's sort of proxy for the rest of the meeting. And I couldn't help but be like, maybe should have just done that for the vote too. Like, cause I'd rather she not participate and, you know, vote by proxy than just like not do it a bit more slow and carefully.
Yeah. I mean, they have to make these decisions quickly, right? So I get that Lucy's probably not in the best headspace after the Finia fight, and therefore is not in a great place to be kind of, okay, resting and thinking through these decisions. But there's not really, I don't know. I think it's good that Avery's, she just ditches and leaves Avery to make the decision, because I think Avery's the only one that's really in the frame of mind to be able to do it right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because this is after she got to go deal with Pam. So, like, Avery has, like, rounded out her loose end.
Yeah, exactly. Avery's much more riding on a high. She had a great interaction with Pam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I thought it was a bit interesting that Lucy seems to be the one here who was just like, oh, bureaucracy. Because I was like, you know, I've bitched about my work on here before, obviously, like, very strong opinions about how too much bureaucracy can be a problem. I don't think that's what this meeting was. I think Lucy was just not in the right headspace to be involved in a decision that deserves the weight this was being given.
I want to call out something that I thought was pretty funny, which is this little moment where Verona has to think of a treat she can give to the spirit of Long, and so she just starts thinking about Long gifts. I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah, did we actually talk like last week or the week before about how interesting it is that she's just taken on the spirit of Long? Like, that's such a neat and like otherverse-y idea. Like, it wasn't a spirit of like getting buff or something, or like, you know, doing big punches. It was like this really kind of abstract and multifaceted. Like, she used it at one point to make her arms long, but from memory, when we were in her head as well, she's also using it to like think long. It's all these interpretations of Long. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's so abstract in a way that that lets it be really multi-purpose in a great kind of, you know, style.
Yeah, it's so much more unique than just having it be like strength or speed or something. I'm just trying to think, like, what else could you do apart from noodles? Because noodles, like, yes, they are long, but like, there's got to be something. Like, what about like, you know, really aged wine or something? You know, like it's been aged for a long time, and you emphasize that part as you like give it the wine. I don't know.
Yeah, Yeah,
get a foot long sub from Subway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Get 2 foot long subs that you've glued together to make a 2 foot long sub.
No, we find one of the ones that does catering, just like the 8 foot long Subway.
Because the way that they make those, Elliot, I don't know if you know this, is they bake an 8 foot long loaf of bread and then make one giant sandwich before chopping it all up.
I've never had Subway catering, so I don't know if you're joking with me or not.
I am joking. That's not how they make that. They just
think their ovens would be big enough.
No. Anyway, back on topic. I kind of wanted to, I mean, we see towards the end of this chapter here and a bit later as well, there's a bit of a, from Lucy's perspective at least, there's a bit of a rift between Verona and Lucy at the moment. And I was kind of like, oh, that's a bit worrying. But then also like, they've just come off of a pretty serious trauma. And maybe their closest thing to a really bad loss. So I don't know. They're in bad headspaces. Let them make it up to each other when they're feeling better.
Yeah, because that's always really been their dynamic. Like, they're very different people, and they work so well as best friends because they take that extra mental step every time they interact of like thinking about the other person's perspective and like understanding them and where they're coming from. Like, they do communicate in different ways, but they're used to it and they work around it. Whereas, yeah, like, they're just too fucking tired and miserable right now to do it. And they're both making mistakes and pissing each other off. And there's very much just this moment where they're both like, let's just stop talking. Like, they're not ready to do the communicating in the way that they need to. Which, again, like, feels like it's continuing to tie into that theme that we've talked about here, Pale, of like, yeah, working together doesn't mean being on the same wavelength. It means getting people on different ones to work together. And as we're seeing, like, the Kennet Council fall a bit apart in that regard, we're also seeing Lucy and Verona do it here. And yeah, I just wonder if that, like, that and Verona's difficulty with the Half-Life stuff is going to sort of be two of the angles we look at the rest of this arc through.
I don't know. We'll see what their relationship looks like. I didn't really get the vibe that it was going that downhill. I think it was just tense moments.
I agree. I think it's just because they're like tired and shitty right now, but it's like,
and clearly pretty stressed, as you would be and should be.
Yeah, like, I think it'll get better, but just like, you know, some simmery tension still maybe being there a little bit as like Verona dabbles with the Half-Life stuff, or as they're trapped together in this room for 2 weeks, like, there's the potential for it to, you know, it just for that be the, like, the straw that breaks the camel's back with something else going wrong. I don't know. Yeah. I think time and time again, the Kennetys have proved that their bonds are too strong to get broken up by, like, petty drama.
I don't
see it heading that way, but it'll be like, you know, that one miscommunication could just lead to something else happening. Last thing we should talk about before, like, we get into the Jasmine scene proper is just as Jasmine picks them up, Verona mentions she's feeling quite unwell, and Jazz asks her where, and she's like, oh, my stomach and I've got a headache. And Lucy's mom's just like, oh, so you're like your usual stress stuff.
Jazz is so on it. She's so on top of this.
I love that because, like, I swear Verona barely makes that connection half the time. But also, just at first I was like, oh, Jasmine, you don't understand. It's actually a lot worse right now. And then I thought about it more and I was like, actually, you know what? That probably is a fair assessment of what's happened to Verona. Like, some of it is like the gainsaying and the Sixberry stuff, but really all those are doing are like causing her the same sorts of stress that her emotional bottling up does. Like, she's hurt herself here with the Sixberry and with the gainsaying, and that's just manifesting in, yeah, that same sort of stress response she has to, you know, being stressed out. Like, I think Lucy's mom's actually more right than Verona and Lucy probably think she is.
Yeah, yeah. Jasmine asks what happened, and the Kenneteers struggle to give any good answers here.
Yeah, Verona goes, like, full Avery for a little bit when Jasmine's like, so what actually happened? And Verona just pauses for a second, and she's like, stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, you can feel Jasmine's blood pressure elevate as, like, that's all they give her. She's like, what the fuck do you mean, stuff?
It's nonsense. But there's this moment where Lucy almost tells Jasmine the truth, and, like, God, such a strength of this story is, I have no fucking clue whether it would have been a good idea or not, but holy shit, it felt like Lucy was about to crack and tell Jasmine the truth, and I was fucking terrified for it.
Yeah, I mean, I love how, really, Lucy's main reason for not wanting to do it, it's to protect her mom, because obviously bringing people into this world is a bad idea in general, but also, like, I love that there's the extra thing of, like, Lucy wants home to be a refuge. Like, she's talked about this in the story before, and she mentions it here, like, whenever shit goes bad, usually she can come home and that's like her safe space. And she, if she awakens her mom or makes her mom aware, she is gonna lose that as far as the magic is concerned.
Oh yeah, 100%.
I think that's a really interesting point though, because, like, on the one hand, like, your mom being able to actually know what the problem is going to help her create, like, more of us. But, like, all this really does is create distance between you and your mom because you can't actually talk about it. Like, is not being able to bring it home in that way healthy, or is that just, like, you know, not dealing with it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think there's a case for her actually getting more comfort at home if she can talk to her mom about, like, the fact that a fairy just tried to sell her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I mean, but the thing is, I was thinking about this. If Lucy tells Jasmine what's going on, like, Jasmine is clearly being an incredibly reasonable parent and will continue to be if she knows about this magic stuff.
Which means she'll make them stop.
Well, exactly, because that's the reasonable thing, right? Like, is like, no, your children, you shouldn't be in this position. Like, get some fucking Blue Heron Institute practitioners involved and disconnect yourselves from it.
Yeah, stop trying to fix the world yourselves.
And that's pretty much exactly what Jasmine says, even without knowing about magic, right? Like, she says, you've always had too much of a sense of justice. You shouldn't have picked an argument with a stranger. And then Lucy and Verona were like, you know, this short older guy told us we should blah, blah, blah. And then Jasmine's response is, well, why didn't he handle it? And I'm just like, even though they're telling Jasmine, in air quotes, lies, Jasmine just kind of immediately is like, gives two very clear and very accurate questions and immediately picks on to, like, the exact right criticism of the situation, even though she's being told, like, 5% of the truth of what happened.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like, it's this weird thing that simultaneously an argument for making her aware or awakening her, and also just, like, not doing that, depending on your perspective of what you want the Kenneteers to be doing. Yeah, as an aside on all this, like, my sister is now, like, halfway through arc 2 of Pale. She's finally reading it. She was saying last night, because she's in town, this is her favorite part of the world so far. Like, the bit that's really jumped out to her is making, like, Pale better than most other stuff she's read is just the fact that, like, innocence makes sense because there's a disincentive to involve both your allies and your enemies. It's just a good point. It's something I often overlook because I'm so used to it now, but, like, it's such a cool mechanic that, like, you know, there's so much to consider when you think of the idea of awakening or making Jasmine aware from the Kenneteers' perspectives that go beyond the uniqueness of their circumstances.
Yeah. I also want to pull out this moment where Jasmine asks if they've had anything to drink and then asks drugs, and Verona says, not my thing. And, like, that Lucy calls this out later as it being effectively a lie, even if it wasn't in the wording. And I'm kind of like, isn't it? Is it?
I had the same response. When I read this the first time, I was like, I think by a lot of definitions, six berry mixture is going to count as a drug, Verona. Like, I don't.
Yeah, and it is 100% her thing, right?
Well, yeah, like, she's got that whole thing with the visions with Melissa. Like,
yep.
Yeah, like, yeah, she says not my thing. I think she wants that to be true, but, like, there's absolutely no denying that, like, it's an idea that has sat around her.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, the six berry mixture not counting is, like, bullshit practitioner technicality shit that, like, the Aurum might let slide, but I'm not gonna.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. I don't know. Anyway, we'll see. Verena's already, you know, taking a power hit, so what's one more lie among friends, I guess. So, yeah, getting home, Jasmine continues to be the world's most reasonable parent, and the girls start to crash.
Yeah, and I really want to call out, as we get into it, the visuals of this scene in the car, like after Jasmine sort of parked it. Like, it's a very, you know, like I've seen a bunch of movies and stuff that do this as well, like where all the light is coming from, the street lights or the light in the house or the reflection of the headlights. It's very dark in the car and you're just getting like people's like silhouettes and stuff. And it just creates this great sense of like distance and sort of like the emotionalness of it all being like really intense, but also you can't quite read it. It's just great how he captures that visual vibe so effortlessly in like written text.
Mm. Yeah. It is, you can really picture this stuff, right? I'm pulling out a line from later in the chapter, but one of my favorite images when we see Alpie later, we get this bit where Lucy's looking at Alpie and we get the line, "Rather than turn her head, she let hair cover her face, then had her face emerge from the morass of matted, damp, gritty hair, out of alignment with neck and body, dark eyes wide." And as soon as I read this, I was just like, holy fuck, this language is so evocative and I just love it so much.
Yeah, and like, that's also, it's a great execution of just a really cool concept. Like, she doesn't turn her head, she just rearranges her head.
Yeah, oh my god, it's so good. She's literally a nightmare and it's just so great.
That's what I love about Alpie, just like conceptually, that she's like this kind of adorable horror movie monster.
Mm.
Like everything we know about Alpie, like when you get to meet her, it's just like, oh, you know, she's just Alpie. Like, you know, she's a bit of a ditz at times, but you know, she's nice and we love her. And then everything she does physically is just straight up nightmare fuel.
Mm.
Or nightmare product, I suppose.
Yeah. Jasmine, I think the general theme here is Jasmine is unreasonably reasonable about everything here. She really is just like incredibly generous to these two in a way that I don't think she needs to be.
Yeah, I think there is an argument for Jasmine being too lenient here. I don't know if that's where I stand, but like, I don't know. She's just like, she doesn't even yell at them. She just like, she communicates really well. I love as well that she qualifies all of her shit with like, these are the punishments I'm giving you, but fair warning, I know that it's really bad right now, so like I might adjust these tomorrow. Like, that's incredibly mature and also gives them a lot of credit for their ability to process that she's going to do that.
Mm.
So yeah, I guess we'll see what she says the next day as the second half of this. But I think the bit where I felt like maybe she's almost too lenient is the part where she does say Lucy gets to go on the date. I don't know.
Mm. I think she mentions some stuff about like not wanting to be her parents and stuff like that. I think that's her trying to be a very like accepting and, you know, I think parenting, especially around like dating and sex for young children, is especially prickly, right? And my read on that was Jasmine's parents were maybe a bit conservative around some of that stuff, and she wants to actively push back against that, which is why she's being, very permissive around it, I think.
I also think if you're Lucy's parent.
yeah, totally. Because it is what Lucy really kind of needs, right? Is some normal interactions.
Jazz must, like, I think, well, from memory, Jazz was like over the moon hearing that like Lucy had like just a normal date with a boy. So there's probably just a big part of her that doesn't want to set Lucy back in that regard. I feel like a big part of, honestly, as well, the reason Lucy probably gets this date is because Lucy doesn't fight that at all. Like, when it comes up, like, oh, granted, for 2 weeks, Verona's the one who's actually like,
about the date?
Lucy has the date, and Lucy's like, it's fine, I can reschedule it. Like, this is fair. And that probably won her a lot of points.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, she's a good kid, that Lucy. She does. Yeah. She's trying her best.
But that said, Jazz also has you know, the reader's interests at heart, because she decides that it has to be a group date, which I think is just very fun, because that just doesn't feel like Lucy's vibe at all to me. Like, I've always read Lucy very much as somebody who hangs out with like a small, close group, not a bigger one. So the idea that it's going to have to be like six people on this group date, it's just, I think it's going to be very fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed Verona said no on her and Jeremy's behalf, because while I think that was absolutely the right call, I would have enjoyed watching that train wreck.
Mm. Yeah. It would have been definitely wild. But I'm glad that Verona has seemingly is starting to get the concept that she shouldn't I mean, it's not quite stringing Jeremy along, but that is basically what it is.
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of encouraging, because on the one hand, it's like the first sign that she is, like as you say, recognizing that she really needs to make sure she's not leading him on or whatever.
Mm.
But I'm a little skeptical as well, because it comes in this form of this date, which she basically says is something he would love to do and I don't want to do.
Mm.
And I feel like the side of this that would really sell it to me, she needs to start doing or turning down things she wants to do as well. Because it's like, if she still does all the things she wants to do, that's just kind of more selfishly leading him on. Like, I mean, what she needs to do is have a fucking conversation with the dude and just like reiterate that they're on the same page. Because I think we were very skeptical when they first got together of the fact that she'd really sold that they're on different pages. So I don't know. I'm still very worried about her and Jeremy's quote-unquote relationship.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I can see it going very badly, or I can see it going mild to positive. So we'll see, I suppose.
It's a good sign that she's noticing this discrepancy in how they feel. I just need to see her starting to act on it or talk about it with him before I can really feel comfortable with what's happening.
Mm. Yeah. Their work is never over, so Lucy summons Alpie to help them conduct some meetings in their sleep while they are grounded.
It's fun. Like, I feel like my guess is at this point we're going to start moving through the days a bit quicker now, kind of like we did in Arc 10, but maybe not that severely.
Mm.
But I'm super interested to see this next section of the story, which feels like it's going to be like everybody regrouping a bit, doing things like interviewing Sig, communicating via the dreams, and I guess getting ready for the actual finale. This should be a really fun, I guess it feels like it's gonna be our final prep session.
It feels like we're gonna head into the final bits of climax with a little nice character moments to give us a bit of downtime before the final showdown, I suppose.
Yeah We'll have Verona making herself not human. Everyone else getting ready normally. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah. That's the end of False Moves 12-3. As well as the end of the main chapters for us to discuss. But fear not, there is more to be discussed. We've got some power predictions coming in. Some predictions from our community on what they think is going to happen next.
So what have you got for us today, Ruben?
I brought in a theory from Captain Rhino, they submitted, basically, I think domain theories are coming in hot and fast now.
Yeah, there were quite a few of those.
Yeah, there was one from, I think, I'm Easily Impressed as well. Captain Rhino's take is a domain ritual is going to challenge everyone. We've just lost Marisica. She's just run off. So Verona will use a domain ritual as a way to draw Marisica back into Kennet and into the open so she can be confronted. And even as an extension of that theory, Marisica wants this to happen because, one, it might expose, if this is Verona's domain, the house on Half Street, which is where they're holding the furs, and two, Verona has been gainsaid, so she's obviously extra vulnerable if she does this ritual. And I just think this all kind of ties together very, very nicely. So, yeah, I like it. I like it.
Yeah. It's hard to know with theories on this stuff because we don't understand what these challenges or whatever look like in practice.
Yeah.
Like, what are the rules around it? Is Verona allowed help? Like, if Marisica challenges her, is, like, Guillaume allowed to be like, well, I'll fight for Verona? Like, can she name a champion? Like, I don't know.
So I
love this theory, but I'm also, I don't know how it works. I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, definitely. I really liked it. I think domain theories are coming in quickly, and I like this one. It feels like it ties together quite nicely.
I really like the point that sort of comes up, which is that the fact that she's gainsaid will further incentivize her to do something like this, because we've already seen her stress about being the one without the power.
Yeah, and exactly.
I think it's going to sit on her, the fact that for the next, you know, 2 weeks, she's going to be incredibly weak.
Yeah.
Something like prematurely launching into a domain ritual is totally a Verona-esque response to that.
What theory did you pull out from the pair prediction sheet?
So I pulled out one from I'm Easily Impressed, and they basically mentioned that in 12.3, Gilmay doesn't actually vote for Marisica's exile, although I checked and it's like briefly mentioned that he did, but he doesn't get singled out like everyone else. And basically I'm Easily Impressed has gone full tinfoil and is guessing that that's not Gilmay, it's actually Marisica. Because they don't sort of actually declare themselves at the meeting, and I don't know that I genuinely believe this, but it's a very fun form of tinfoil that I can get behind.
I like crazy theories like this, but I think this one might have been submitted before Wobber didn't edit. So there was originally in 12.3, Gilmay wasn't explicitly mentioned in the voting scene, but there was a bit where it was like, oh, you know, the remaining people and some goblins voted and it was unanimous, which was then changed to Gilmay and the remaining goblins voted and it was unanimous, because people were like, oh, did Gilmay not vote? So maybe this is where this theory came from.
That would be fair. This often happens to me because I read the chapters late. I miss the edits because I only see the edited one.
Yeah.
Like it came up last week when we're saying that about the cherry pop, like things being misspelled. I was surprised that I was seeing that, because usually they're fixed by the time I'm getting to the chapters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just checking when this one was actually made.
So yeah, this might have been a pre-edit, or, you know, if I'm Easily Impressed read the chapter before the edit and didn't see that there was an edit, you know, it's possible.
No, yeah, you're right. I think this came out, I think this prediction was made about 45 minutes after the chapter came out. So yeah, okay. Like that chucks.
So yeah.
My bad.
No, I mean, I still like the Gilmay secretly is working with Marisica type of theories. Or this one is actually, Gilmay is actually Marisica, which is a more wild version of the theory.
As anyway. I said, before I even do about this clarification, I was still kind of like, I don't know if I buy it, but it's the kind of tinfoil that I can get behind.
So yeah. but our pale predictions. If you have a pale prediction, you can leave it in our pale predictor form, which will be linked in the show notes down below. But before we wrap up, we also should revisit some of these discussion question answers, Elliot, because we've been running a discussion question for the last fortnight, which was, if you were subverting yourself to fight a fairy, what practice would you lean into and what animal would your mask be? E.g., what's the part of yourself that you've kind of intentionally shied away from that you would lean into? What a great discussion question.
I do want to thank everyone who answered, because there's a lot of you mentioned in your answers. It was a fairly intense and personal discussion question. So thank you for taking the time to answer it despite that.
Yeah, definitely this one got a little bit heavy. So thanks everyone who was being kind of vulnerable with their answers. But yeah, I really, really liked this discussion question, and it's for the reason why I like the Otherverse in general, which is like these fictional magical concepts, but they're also very, very, very different and interesting kind of narrative-esque lenses to analyze yourself or others with, right? It's like this way to think about things in a slightly different way that encourages you to come to new understandings about yourself or whatever you're kind of analyzing. And I thought this was a delightful way to frame that, and we got some really, really fun answers as a result.
Yeah, this is a world built on the importance of meaning and understanding, and so many of the things within it are then useful for like analyzing characters or people and like yourself. Like, I remember we ran into this, I think like our very first discussion question in Deep Impact was like, what would your implement be or something? And then it was like, then we decided to answer it for ourselves, and it was like, oh, holy shit, this is like a very kind of intense personal journey you have to go on. Before we get into specific things, I did want to call out two trends, just because we'll sort of skim over these in some of the answers, but The first one specifically is that a lot of you seem to have read a lot of packed dice materials and mentioned a lot of packed dice stuff that I don't think has come up in Pale.
Mm.
So we're going to kind of skim over some of those answers, I'm sorry, in part because I didn't understand them because I have not read most of the packed dice things, but also just to generally avoid packed spoilers.
Yeah. I think it's also kind of worth noting that, like, a lot of these responses do get quite personal and a lot of them are quite long and in-depth, and I loved all of them so much, but because of the format of our show, we're going to have to be a little bit light on them. So, again, just like, if you want, totally just go read them and cut off the podcast here because they're all delightful.
The other trend I want to call out is that I noticed that probably 80% of the answers involved people saying that their normal form of practice would be something, you know, very hands-off or like very academic, sort of subtle or whatever. And most people, when trying to subvert that, went down paths that became a lot more physical or brutish.
Mm.
And I'm just starting to realize that perhaps the people answering our discussion questions from a podcast on a web serial are a bit nerdy.
Mm. Yeah. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
So yeah, should we get into some? Do we want to pull out some that were our favorites?
Yeah.
I'm looking through the notes and there were like so many. I mean, this was maybe our most popular discussion question yet. So there were 20 maybe answers across the two threads. So
yeah,
I don't know if we can go into all of them, but so they were all so delightful.
Yeah. God, sorry. I'm just, you're right. There's so many.
Yeah.
I wanted to call out Ace of Sword, who...
Yeah, yeah. I love this one.
Sort of would normally see themselves as probably being like a bit of a collector, which I think normally a collector is someone like Bristow, except they collect things, not people, which is a little bit more... like my character in Pace. So they were a little unsure what practice they'd actually lean into if they were subverting themselves. But what I thought was really interesting about Ace of Swords is they had a very clear idea for what their alternative mask would be. Like, they thought it would be a bull.
Yeah.
They sort of mentioned, you know, they can be quite a big person and have had some issues with sort of anger management or stubbornness. Like, they brought up not being allowed to use drills as a kid, but getting the drill bits and manually drilling through wood
by hand turning a drill bit, which is crazy. And I think therefore means the bull mask 100% fits. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But like, so I had real, real fun after reading this answer being like, okay, well, how can we go from that bull mask and the logic behind that to turn that into a practice?
Mm.
And so it seemed like very stubborn and single-minded to me. And I got like, do you remember those incarnations that we met in the ruins? Like Yearning
and all
them?
Yeah.
I feel like dealing with like maybe more anger-driven ones of those would suit this bull. Like being somebody who deals with, like the people who were fighting John, like people working for war or something, like very much doubling down on this one energy and then just like becoming that and like channeling that and using it like brutishly.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm sure the people who answered this who are very familiar with Pack Dice are probably listening to what I'm saying and have a multitude of suggestions for better fits. I'm sorry, I don't know all these practices.
But yeah, I liked Ace of Swords' response and especially the theories about the bull mask stuff. I want to pull out Hero Vorpal's answer, which is another one I really liked. The kind of flaw that they thought they would touch on was their kind of desire to, you know, a tendency to think, okay, I know the right answer here, so I'll just kind of bluster over everybody and get them to go with what I know is the correct answer, even if it's not necessarily what they want to do in a situation, right? I love that. I love them recognizing this flaw and looking at it and going, okay, well, how can I do this? Maybe some kind of like inch. I mean, that's a very practitionery thought in and of itself, right? So kind of enchanty, they pulled out the spider mask with this quote of trapping someone in their own web, but for their own good, which I just thought was so delightfully villainous that it would fit perfectly in the practitioner universe.
Yeah, it definitely felt similar to the energy we saw from Avery in these chapters.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love this idea of like Because I definitely remember being like that in my past as well. Like that idea of like thinking you know what's right for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, if I was in charge, it would all be better.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And yeah. I think like leaning into that impulse, I think most of us have had, is a really like interesting lens.
Yeah. Another one that I also really liked was Ascending Dragon, who kind of thinks about, you know, a lot of people, the way they did this was focus on what they think their practitioner, you know, specialty or mask would be, and then what a kind of subversion of that is. And Ascending Dragon got to this subversion of like basically just leaning into the tendency of them wanting to stop other people from winning more than winning on their own terms. In the sense of, you know, sports they played and stuff like that, where their basic goal was to be a spoiler, right? Somebody who spoiled what other people were doing.
Yeah.
And I just love that. And I love that this was something they wrote 2 weeks ago, and now it's very much ties into the themes of the wolf in Avery's, you know, 12.2 chapter. I just thought that was delightful. So I thought it was worth bringing up.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I loved that sort of movement of like, oh, rather than like being somebody who's all about like protection.
Mm.
Instead moving into kind of first striking, like
mm.
very aggressive protection. Yeah. I guess on a very similar sort of note, Jarl Zahl had an interesting one. They sort of mentioned they generally value having like a big tool set. I think they talked about being a collector as well.
Mm.
But like, you know, their focus tends to be like being on the side and not sort of being the front man. Mm. But they used to play a lot of contact sports and do things like cross country. So they reckon like an alternate path for them that they could lean into for this sort of situation would be really fast, like speed-based in your face practices. So they name dropped like stuff like goblins and things, but like I got like very Avery wielding her hockey stick vibes from how they described it. And they talked about having a cheetah mask because cheetahs are all about speed and they tackle their prey, but they're not stealth or trickery, which would be Jarl Zahl's normal thing. Like it's moving away from stealth and tricks to just like, I will run you down and tackle you.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. I really liked Kippos's answer. Kippos wrote, it definitely read like a bit of a short story, right? Where it was almost a description of somebody, somebody that really rode the line between practitioner and other, I think, and existed in online spaces. I think a very personal one, and I feel weird about kind of analyzing it, especially because it is personal to Kippos, but I just thought it was a great, absolutely great piece of writing and a really great, I don't know, self-reflective, a great example of what I mentioned before as a self-reflective tool, I suppose.
Yeah, like Kippos sort of mentioned in her follow-up comment, like basically this was the version of herself she saw that didn't ever bother trying to learn to empathize with people. And like you really sort of felt that in the writing.
It was, it felt very sad. It was like,
yeah.
It was very, in a very otherverse way, very tragic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't write themselves a happy ending.
No, and not like clearly a character that was intentionally somewhat malicious, but in a very kind of Greek tragedy kind of way, I guess, where their maliciousness also was just ruining themselves and poisoning themselves.
Yeah.
Mm.
We also got a response from Megafire, who, if that same name sounds familiar to you, it's because you can listen to them last week.
Yeah.
And Megafire brought up this really interesting point that they tend to avoid drugs and alcohol because they really value having control of their mind and like, you know, being able to respond the way they want to. And so, yeah, like basically that really valuing self-control in that way. So they might try to let go of that in order to subvert themselves to fight a fairy. So something like alchemy, like Verona's experimenting with, or like maybe some of the stuff like Matthew did in Edith's interlude, like, you know, when he souped himself up to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Megafire paired that with like a sort of monkey mask, like, you know, to tap into this sort of sense of like getting, I guess, more animalistic and leaving aside their ability to like have self-control.
Yeah. Yeah. another great response. Loved it.
Yeah.
Any other ones you really want to pull out, Elliot? I could read through these all day, but, you know.
I'm easily impressed. Wrote one that felt like it was a bit of a personal attack on me because it's talking about how being a collector is bad, and so they would be a collector because they're currently trying to avoid being a hoarder. And that is something I definitely battle with every day.
Mm. Yeah.
And we should really call out Stuck in Reddit Factories answer, which was the last one we got right at the end here. Stuck in Reddit Factories said they were the first in their family to finish high school, and they also graduated from university. And they said, you know, they specifically chose avoiding things like working in a butcher's shop and stuff in order to, like, chase academia. So that's what they could lean into. And what they were saying is they're very into, like, cooking. And I think the implication was that their, like, degree is in chemistry.
Mm.
So, like, taking all of that, like, cooking and chemistry energy and sort of twisting it to be much more, like, butchery focused. So, like, focus on the part of food preparation that's the, like, killing and the disassembling of the meat. I really liked this answer. Yeah. Like, that's a really interesting thought.
Gruesome and grisly, but I did quite like it.
And, like, they mentioned having a pig mask because, you know, pigs are, like, brutish and greedy, and they'll, like, sniff out.
They definitely have that stereotype, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, not all. Like, you know, Wilbo's avatar's a pig. He's got a pig mask.
And I think pigs are meant to be quite smart and intelligent creatures. So let's not be too mean to them. But yes, they definitely are, like, you know.
These are Stuck in Reddit Factory's words, not mine.
Yeah. All right. Watch yourself, Elliot.
there are definitely, because isn't there, like, a whole thing with having pigs as pets?
Mm.
Oh, there's, like, some movie coming out with Nicolas Cage. Did you see the trailer for that?
Yeah, Pig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looks good. Wild. And then there's, like, you know, Okja or, like, Babe. I mean, these are all pigs. These are all movies that are like, oh, well, pigs are actually good. but, yeah, anyway.
But, no, there's definitely, like, yeah, like, evil pig imagery with, like, yeah, like the I really liked Stuck in Reddit Factory's point of, like, yeah, like, using their sort of nose to sniff out and, like, like, find the prizes and things that are hidden by stuff like glamour, and then just, like, being greedishly brutish about it all.
Yeah. So, yeah, I loved all of these answers. I thought they were all really great, and thank you all for leaving them. But we have a new discussion question for some new great answers. Ellie, do you want to introduce this one?
Yeah, this one has ended up being quite similar to that previous one in its sort of vibe, I guess. So hopefully everyone's ready for more self-reflection. because basically now that we sort of understand what the wolf is, I think, that it's your antagonist, our discussion question is, what form would your wolf take?
Mm.
Or I suppose, look, if you had enough of the self-reflection in the last 2 weeks, pick, like, another character from a popular story, or another Wildbo character or something, and say what you think their wolf would look like. But yeah, like, whatever. Just, like, I want to explore this idea of, like, both in personality and appearance, what does someone's antagonist look like?
I think it's fun. Pick a fun character or take the lens to yourself again, and let's see what happens. You can, of course, leave your answers to that discussion question in our discussion threads, which we linked in the show notes below.
Yes. Don't forget, those show notes also contain a link to all the rules on the fan art contest. So if you can draw, and honestly, even if you can't, check that out. Try and submit something to us, you know, and see if you can win the cash prize.
You can find more information about that or all the other great shows on the Doof Media Network at the Doof Media website, doofmedia.com, including all the other great shows on the network. I know the Doofcast just released their episode on Bo Burnham's Inside that has kind of taken the internet by storm. So that's definitely one that I'm looking forward to listening to.
Yeah, I think it's also, when this is coming out, the book club has happened about 8 hours ago, and the game club is happening
In about 8 hours.
So yeah, the book club was just on, I think it's Foucault's Pendulum.
Yeah.
It sounds like a very dense book. I did not keep up with that one. But in the Game Club, we'll be talking about a much less dense story-wise thing. We're talking about Doom,
yeah.
The 2016 one.
You've finally taken all the advice of all those people who keep telling you to go to hell, Elliot. and we'll be talking about your experiences there on the Game Club. So join us for that.
If you like this show or any of our other shows, check out the Doof Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. We only get to do the things we do because of that Patreon. In fact, we've just been buying a lot of equipment for our live stream, which we're very excited for. And that is all coming from funds that we've been allocated via that Patreon.
Yeah, we've kind of been leaving money that we've been earning from the Patreon in our account for a while, waiting for the right thing to spend it on. And oh boy, some of the stuff that we are buying, y'all. I'm so fucking excited. I wanted to mention it, but I know it will start to spoil things. So I can't, but I want to so bad.
It is getting harder to not mention some of the stuff.
Some of the things we got planned is fucking wild. Also, while you're on Patreon, do make sure you head on over to Wild Bo's Patreon. Otherwise, it's going to ground you for at least 2 weeks. You can support him and make sure that he has the resources to keep doing what we love him for doing, which is writing these wonderful stories.
Absolutely. And so with that, we'll see you next week for more False Moves.
Mm-hmm.